Talk Show.
Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven, saying, Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge of Babylon, we are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is May 9th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is here for the fifth and what may likely be the final installment of the Spanish Civil War, Bolshevism's Iberian aspirations, or more properly put, the Bolshevik Revolution in Spain. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh. And yes, I hope it's the final one, but it had to be covered, and it had to be illustrated, the things that the Bolshevik Jews did in Spain. There's no doubt.
Well, I don't think we could get
another branch of the Jewish conquest of Christianity.
It's just another limb of Satan. It's a different way in which we experience Satan. As I've said earlier, you know, some people, we experience Satan in the form of masonry. In Spain, they experienced Satan in the form of anarchism and Bolshevism.
Absolutely.
And incidentally, it was organized in the Masonic Lodges. The Masonic Lodges are basically temples of Satan, aren't they?
Well, the Jews have used those organizations as anti-God, anti-Christian organizations, and they've used them to perpetrate much of their evil, yes.
I know a Mason, though, a 32nd degree Mason. He's not a Christian by any measure. He says that he doesn't like that dogmatic believe this or go the hell attitude. But he said that the people living in Palestine today are not the people of David. That's what he said. He said that they are Khazars and they have no rightful place being there. And he then went on to say that they seem to have embarked on a campaign to wipe us out. And I'm assuming by us.
Well, he's
white.
Not a 33rd degree Mason.
Mm.
There's a big difference.
Mm.
In that one degree, there's a big difference.
So they're probably not going to tap him to become a 33rd.
No, and there's many, you know, most Masons think that they're a good community organization doing good for the community
and doing
the right thing.
I asked him what his opinion of Masonry was, and he said they make bad men worse. He said they claim they make good men better, but he said in his experience they make bad men worse and that they're basically a bunch of thieves, hypocrites, and liars and cheaters. So would you say that's a pretty candid and honest assessment of Masonry?
Well, that seems to be the record that most of them have had. The hand of Masonry in the New World Order conspiracy for Jewish world supremacy is pretty clear.
And he told me, too, that he believes that there were once giants alive in the world and that the powers that be are trying to conceal that so we don't know anything about the origins of the world. I'm sure they're never going to tap him to become a 33rd.
No.
In fact, if they tap him, it'll be for an assassination.
They are not above that.
All right, then. So we spent probably 15 hours discussing Bolshevism in Russia. We got 9 shows out of that, so we are on the fifth and probably final show here. But as you said, it had to be covered. People had to see that this is not just a anomalous event, some crazy, bizarre, fluke occurrence in Russia. There is a pattern here. It's happening in country after country. It would have happened in Germany were it not for the Freikorps. It happened in Bavaria, and the Freikorps put an end to it. You remember the Bavarian Soviet Republic?
Well, right, and they tried it in Munich and Hamburg also.
Mm-hmm. In fact, there was a Bolshevik revolution in Calgary, Canada. Did you know that?
I'm sorry. Bavaria, Munich is in Bavaria. They tried it in Hamburg and in the Rhineland also.
There was a several-month-long Bolshevik commune in Calgary, Canada, I think in the early 20s, and the police didn't put it down. They let it go on for several months, and some Jewish gangster, who was also a communist anarchist type, he purged some of his enemies. There were riots, a lot of deaths. This kind of mayhem went on for several months. He lined his own pockets, and finally, I think citizens rose up and put an end to it, and he fled. You know, they apparently, the police out there in Alberta, they didn't mind stopping the anti-Chinese riots in 1890, but the anti-German riots in 1915, they couldn't do anything about that, sadly, and they couldn't do anything about this Jew setting up a commune in Calgary. That's ridiculous, that there was a communist commune in Calgary and most people are having a clue about it.
Right. I'd like to, somebody in a forum, Matt said that Freemasonry originated from the Hebrews, and that's absolutely unsubstantiated claim of Freemasons.
Yes. They claim that they built the Temple of Solomon, but Gerald down in Louisiana has books that definitively establish Masonry did not even exist at all until the opening two decades of the 18th century, the 1700s,
right.
Specifically around 1706 to 1716, probably.
Right.
That's when Masonry was laid down.
And they've consistently made ancient claims to themselves that aren't substantiated whatsoever.
Well, they claim that the records that predate the 1700s were burned by anti-Masons. And then when I ask, well, what about the records detailing the great anti-Masonic fires? Oh, those were all burned, too. And conveniently, all their records are burned.
Well, it's just like the Mormon Golden Book, you know. I want to see it.
Well, where is this Golden Book?
I want to translate it.
I don't think there is any such book.
I think the important thing to show, I'd like to finish up Carr here tonight and discuss this this article from the New York Times from last year celebrating an anniversary of the Spanish Civil War.
Who's celebrating it?
Well, the Jews, of course.
Year right now?
Well, it was a museum. It was a museum exhibition in New York commemorating an anniversary that the New York Times just – it's the propaganda is astounding. The way they portray the Bolshevik effort in Spain to this day such a rosy, good – light, like it was a good thing and it was democracy and it failed and we were evil for letting it fail. We should have never let it fail. And it's just terrible.
Well, the Republicans, they called themselves Republicans. They were really crypto-Jews and crypto-Bolsheviks. They did not have a mandate from the masses. Hitler did, but he's demonized as some thug who seized power. In fact, in one of his speeches, he says that Roosevelt has called me a gangster, but this term is particularly irrelevant and meaningless in this context since gangsterism originated in America. So here they are calling Hitler a gangster, but how many Bonnie and Clydes and John Dillingers were there running around Germany? And if there were any, they were all Jews, like the Jews that killed the hostages in Munich in the 20s. We won't see a movie about that, but we will see a Steven Spielberg movie about the assassination of Israeli athletes in Munich, but we'll never hear about all the hostages that the Bolsheviks killed in Munich when the Freikorps crushed the Bavarian Soviet Republic. You know, they were holding hundreds of hostages.
What we don't understand is that the Jews have been conducting a war against Christianity openly for 5,000 years, but
absolutely
openly in our society today for at least 300 years, and we don't understand that every Jewish-owned media outlet, every Jewish-owned Hollywood filmmaker, every Jewish-owned newspaper, magazine, website is only a public relations firm for the Jewish war effort against Christianity. That's all it is.
They're just limbs of Satan, basically.
Every single one of them. That's all they are.
Most people can't.
And we support them. We support them. Christians have supported them for 300 years.
If we didn't buy into their system, it would collapse overnight.
Now the catch 22 situation. The problem with an open and free society, that which we're so proud of, is that we don't recognize the need to restrain the people that really just want to destroy the open and free society.
They use the freedoms against us.
Yes, they do, because they too have the same freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as they come to power, they look to restrain it.
As soon as they come to power, they purge their own. They purge all the useful idiots who talked about civil rights. So by censoring those people, we actually do them a favor because they're not going to wind up against the wall as useful idiots.
Right, and we can, you know, the ADL is so sure of Jewish power here in America that they're looking to restrain free speech now with every passing moment.
Well, they don't need free speech anymore since they're in power.
Well,
In the 50s, they needed free speech, and they had to appeal to our desire for justice and fair play. Now they don't have to even make that pretense anymore. They don't care.
Right, because they're assured of their power, at least in their own minds.
And I'm sure I'm too young to remember this, but maybe in your generation, they would howl and scream for fair play, equal time, equal access, whatever they call it. And yet, as soon as they're in power, fair time, equal access, that's gone. Conservatives are shoved out.
But that's okay, because as soon as they cry peace and security, Yahweh, our God, will crush them.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I've said to people, it's in Jeremiah. They say, peace, peace. Well, show me the peace. There is no peace.
Okay, shall we proceed with William Guy Carr?
Yes, would you like to begin?
Study of the methods employed by the Illuminati's agents in Spain is of great value to those who would protect their country from the danger of similar tribulations. Revolutionary leaders have cells, occupy key positions in jails, prisons, and asylums. Their purpose is to control these institutions so they can release the antisocial elements under detention and use them as shock troops during the revolt. In every revolution to date, the antisocial prisoners and the criminally insane have been used to arouse the bloodlust in the mob and thus introduce the quote-unquote reign of terror, which the revolutionary leaders calculate will cause the general public to surrender in the quickest possible time. Sorry.
I think we're seeing that to an extent in this country, aren't we? It seems that the criminals outnumber the police almost 2-1. Be they the biker thugs, the gangbangers, the antisocial misfits and miscreants, the people who call themselves National Socialists, but they look like they're circus show freaks with all the tattoos and the piercings, and if they were around, Hitler would have thrown them in Dachau.
How about the Bloods and the Crips and the every Mexican's a criminal. Every Mexican is an invader. And the criminals probably outnumbered the police in this country 50-1. It's
amazing.
Yes, and we just let them run rampant. I mean, every ghetto Negro is a criminal. And fortunately, they usually only kill each other.
You know, they say 50% of all mestizos are here illegally. So is it really unfair? Is it really biased? Is it really profiling to stop every single mestizo and say, where's your citizenship documents? Are you a citizen? Since chances are, 1 out of 2 are not citizens. You know, I mean, if 50% of all white people were rapists and molesters, I'd be okay with them stopping me and saying, hey, white man, prove you're not this, prove you're not that. But that's just not the case. 90% of Mexicans could be illegal, and they'd still bellyache and moan. They don't care about legal, illegal. They just want to increase their racial numbers so they can take our country from us. They want to steal what is not theirs. They want
to
take our
birthright. Well, it's an invasion. It's there's no doubt that this Mexican illegal alien problem is not an invasion.
It's a curse from God.
The Jew media wants to promote this as being good. They want to bring this down upon us. It is a curse from God that it's allowed to happen. That our people are blind to it is the effect of the curse of their own disobedience. If they weren't in the bars, if they weren't in the porno shops, if they didn't accept the sexual deviance, if they weren't tied up with the entertainment industry, with drugs, with all these other destructive worldly influences, then we wouldn't have this problem.
Basically, the white man is asleep at the switch, and now the gates are open and the enemies are flooding in.
Well, I mean, I think it was Thomas Jefferson that said that eternal liberty required eternal vigilance.
And we haven't been vigilant. We've basically dropped the ball.
Ever since the Gilded Age, I think, this is where I put it, of the 1890s,
mm-hmm.
have we been in practically total sin, and by that I mean caught up in sports, entertainment, the pursuit of luxuries, consumerism, the feel-good culture of drinking and revelry, and it's been going on for over 100 years.
If it feels good, do it. Well, you know, that's not the ancient attitude of our ancestors and our forefathers. I learned in Greek philosophy, Plato and Socrates said, it may feel good, but it may not be good, that good is not a feeling which a drug could mirror. Good is a state of being. It either is or it is not. It's objective. And I think we've gotten away from that kind of virtue. They've totally Judaized our culture and our thought processes.
Well, when people accepted those little electronic idols in their living rooms with that spew nothing but Jewish filth, that they asked for that.
Mm-hmm.
The prison policy in Madrid was influenced greatly by the advice given the authorities in the Popular Front government by, quote-unquote, General Kleber. the Canadian-Russian who, after taking theoretical training in the Lenin Institute in Moscow, was sent to Spain to serve Stalin and obtain practical experience in revolutionary warfare.
Now, as General Kleber, is he actually a Canadian, or is he just some Jew who happened to live in Canada?
That's what I would guess. As soon as the Popular Front government took office in March 1936, the extreme leftist members insisted that an amnesty bill be passed, granting liberty to all those who had taken part in the Asturian Rebellion. In addition to this small, and we've seen that here today, I mean, look at this, Bill Ayers is allowed to run the streets, right?
Okay.
He's not only running the streets, but he's teaching people how to teach our children.
Okay, Bill, you want to know General Kleber's real name? He was born Lazar Stern. He was also known as Moshe Stern. He was a member of the Soviet Military Intelligence, GRU. He served as a spy in the United States and a military advisor in China. He gained fame as General Kleber, leader of the International Brigades during the Spanish Civil War. He was born in Austria-Hungary. And as I said, his name was Lazar Stern, also known as Moshe Stern. So that's everything you need to know about him.
Well, absolutely, and Carr doesn't go far enough in identifying the true nature of the enemy. In addition to his small army of revolutionaries, 30,000 others who had been arrested as communists were given their liberty. After July 17th, another 40,000 common criminals were released on condition that they would bear arms in the Loyalist Army. The Loyalist Army. Revolutionary leaders liquidate most of the common criminals after they have served their purpose. By doing so, they convince a great many people that the atrocities committed during the revolution were the crimes of irresponsibles acting on their own initiative and not in accordance with the preconceived plan of terrorism, as we saw in Bolshevik Russia. These were the conditions existing when General Franco decided he would try to save Spain from communistic tyranny. Many books have been written telling how Franco and a mere handful of Spanish generals finally managed to defeat the communist plot. It is an exciting story of courage and fortitude and a great faith in a Christian crusade. None of those books are available in libraries here today. As soon as Franco issued his proclamation, the Red Undersecretaries for Army, Navy, and Air ordered the communist cells to liquidate all officers as listed enemies. This task was carried out with great thoroughness. Communist cells had been placed in the mechanical communications and signals branches of the services. And today we have Negroes in the armories. Proved the organizers were sticking to the pattern laid down for the English, French, Russian, and German revolts. Taken by surprise, nearly two-thirds of the officers were murdered cold-bloodedly during the initial stages of the attack. The mutineers tried to convince other ranks and ratings that they were carrying out the government's orders and executing officers who had been convicted as enemies of the Popular Front. Many men would not believe what they were told. Before long, it was not uncommon for one warship to be seen firing at a range of only a few yards into another. In one case, the fore turret was manned by Reds, and the after turret of the same ship was manned by anti-Reds. The massacres which started aboard the ships spread to the dockyards and the cities in which they were located. There might have been some excuse for the drastic action taken against the officers who could be expected to take sides with Franco, but it is impossible to excuse the terrorism which the communists, acting as soldiers and police of the Popular Front government, inflicted upon the unarmed and unsuspecting populace. The imposition of terrorism proved, at the cost of hundreds of thousands of innocent lives, that Lenin's policy had been accepted. He ruled that terrorism had to accompany every violent effort to overthrow a government, because terrorism was the most economic method of subjugating the masses quickly and thoroughly. Television has taken them way too long in this country. But they're about there.
Well, you know, I think they are getting ready to use the military for a crackdown. My friend who's in the military told me that they've been giving a lot of lectures about domestic policing, internal security, and discussing how you spot terrorists. And he said that by their criteria, I'm a terrorist and he's a terrorist. Domestic terrorists.
Well, we're all terrorists. We're all terrorists. If you're a Christian, you're a terrorist.
That's
the way it is. That's the way they feel. And the government agents, yeah, you know, government members of Obama's government have come out and said it. Janet Napolitano being one of them.
Rahm
Emanuel. And I think that that Southers character, I think I have a tape of him on my website, identifying Christians as a threat to national security.
I saw the video footage of Rahm Emanuel saying that if you're on the no-fly list as maybe a possible terrorist, you don't get to have a gun. Well, what is maybe a possible terrorist? Is that the burden of proof now? You may be a possible terrorist? Isn't everyone maybe a possible terrorist?
Well, that sounds like me, somebody that would use the word Jew without salaming to a picture of Marx or Lenin. Every revolt, I'm sorry, it must be remembered that the leaders of a revolution don't consider the effort entirely wasted if it doesn't end in a proletarian dictatorship. Every revolt against constituted government and lawful authority is considered by those who plot and plan revolutionary efforts as a step in the right direction. We definitely saw that in the 60s here, right? If the effort falls short of a success that is bad but not hopeless, it doesn't matter how many people are killed. They are just pawns in a game. They are expendable. It is extraordinary how few of the top-level revolutionary leaders get killed during a rebellion. It is accepted as a good revolutionary technique to sacrifice the masses and preserve the members of the Illuminati, for they are to govern the new order. And it says exactly that in the Protocols of Zion. It says that the masses of Jews would be sacrificed for the goals of Jewry.
Well, they don't really care about, as Eli termed it, the lesser brethren, do they?
No, they don't. They don't even care about their own people. It's incredible.
The kingdom is divided against itself, isn't it?
Well, it always has been, fortunately for us.
Well, when they're that proud and that haughty, they have Satan's blood in them. He rose up against God. They're all going to want to be the leader of hell, aren't they? Every Jew wants to be the king of hell.
Absolutely. Even in ordinary strikes, the Reds usually stir up the trouble and then sneak away. They leave the other workers to do the actual fighting with the police or the militia. The following facts are given to prove that during a revolution, everyone who is not a party member or a fellow traveler may expect no mercy of any kind. Even fellow travelers are liquidated after they have been used to advantage. Prior to July 1936, the directors of the WRM had literally flooded Madrid with agents. Moses Rosenberg arrived as Moscow's ambassador to Madrid.
He must be an Englishman.
Antonov Avsenko arrived in Barcelona. Dimitrov arrived to personally conduct the religious persecutions planned to follow the communist coup. During the Civil War, Rosenberg ruled as Tsar of Madrid. Avsenko assumed command of the Catalan Red Army. Rosenberg organized the Cheches in Spain and saw that they carried out the work of spying out more and more victims. Moscow's agents organized purification squads. Officially, their duty was to seek out fascists, but they secretly liquidated all those who had been previously listed as reactionaries to the Illuminati's plan for the subjugation of Spain. These lists had been compiled by communist spies who had been worked into the Union of Concierges, which are house and apartment janitors, basically, the tax departments, the postal services, and other public offices. The lists of those to be liquidated were very complete because Moscow spies, some disguised as scissors and knife grinders, had covered every district street by street and house by house. All citizens were listed according to their political, labor, social, and religious standing and affiliations. Sounds like the United States Census. When the order for the Reign of Terror to start was given, the communists worked with the sureness, the ferocity, and the thoroughness of starved brutes. Stalin had once stated, "It is better that 100 innocent people die than one reactionary should escape." They obeyed this order with devilish persistency, just like the United States Census takers. So others who live in countries not yet subjugated may understand what happens during a reign of terror. Some actual atrocities will be described. On July 17, 1936, a group of communists wearing the uniforms of government troops called at the Dominican convent in Barcelona. The leader informed the Mother Superior that because mob violence was feared, He had orders to escort the sisters to a place of safety. The sisters gathered together their few belongings and, unsuspectingly, accompanied the soldiers who took them to the suburbs, where they murdered them all. The leader callously remarked afterwards, "We needed the building. We didn't want to muss it up before we occupied it." Senor Salvins was a known anti-communist. Three times, purification squads visited his home in Barcelona. When the third visit produced no information regarding his whereabouts, the Reds murdered the entire family of eight. That vile deed was performed in accordance with paragraphs 15 and 16 of the instructions already referred to, which we read last week. One of the most senseless acts of violence ever committed in the name of, quote, liberty, equality, fraternity, unquote, was the murder of 16 lay brothers who worked voluntarily as male nurses in the largest hospital in Barcelona. Their only crime was that they belonged to a religious order. The fact that they nursed all who were sick, regardless of class, color, or creed, made no difference to those who ordered their, quote-unquote, liquidation. E. M. Godin, who published Conflict in Spain on page 72, reported, "The slaughter of the living was accompanied by derision for the dead. During the last week of July 1936, the bodies of nuns were exhumed from their graves and propped up outside the walls of their convents. Obscene and offensive placards were attached to their bodies. My cousin Tom Carr was a mining engineer in Spain from 1919 until 1938. He was married to the daughter of Mr. Alcock, the American consul of Huelva. One of Caballero's fifth columnists had been elected mayor of Huelva. When Moscow gave the word, he turned over the civic administration to the communists. Their first act was to torture and then murder all the priests. The nuns were stripped naked and driven from the convents into the streets to provide sport for the revolutionaries." Godin also states that he interviewed two English women who only escaped molestation because they were foreigners. These two women told Godin that they had been forced to witness a mob of men and women act like fanatical dervishes. In the first instance, the Reds tortured and mocked a priest before they finally hung his dismembered body and limbs from a statue of the Blessed Virgin. In the second instance, the mob drilled a hole through the body of a young priest and then, while he was living, transfixed him with a crucifix. In September 1936, Pierre Van Roy, famous French author, reported Dimitrov as saying, quote, "We are reproached with destroying the churches and convents of Spain. What does the destruction of a few convents and churches matter? We are out to create a new world."
A Jewish world.
Absolutely Jewish world. A godless Jewish world.
Isn't that what Maurice Samuel said, that we are the destroyers and we will remain the destroyers? Nothing you Gentiles can do can satisfy us because we want the world of our own.
Well, if the real record of the Jews were ever made known to the general public, and the general public did not realize that the Jews were Satan, that then there's no saving anybody. Because they are Satan. There's no doubt. A committee which officially investigated communist atrocities in Spain in 1939 agreed that a conservative estimate placed 50,000 as the number of citizens liquidated in Barcelona as reactionaries between July 1936 and December 1937. In Valencia, the number was set at 30,000. In Madrid, they estimated that fully one-tenth of the whole population was systematically murdered to make Spain into another totalitarian state. To illustrate what happened when the Reds took over control in Spain, I will quote some other independent witnesses. Marcel M. Dutré, the famous French author, stated, "At Castre Urdiales, the communist military commandant was an ex-municipal policeman who had been dismissed for theft. The new chief of police had previously made his living making and selling obscene postcards." I'll bet he was a Jew. "The public prosecutor was the illegitimate son of a woman who had been previously a well-known streetwalker. He was nicknamed Son of His Mother, the matriarchal Jew. The Red Tribunal was presided over by a minor who was assisted by two assessors. All these men were sadists. They glorified in carrying out the sentences they themselves imposed on their victims. They opened the stomach of Vincent Mura. They martyred Julie Yanko publicly in the market square. They dismembered Varez, the famous Spanish racing motorist, on the grounds that he refused to betray his friends into their hands. Mr. Arthur Bryant, who wrote the preface to the fully evidenced and authenticated report on communist atrocities in Spain, remarked on several occasions, Soviet agents obtained such a control of the communication systems that only reports favorable to their cause got into the majority of the world's newspapers. And that's still true in America today. But on the other hand, the most outrageous lies against the Franco forces were conjured up and given to the press of the world without let or hindrance. Bryant was so disgusted with what he saw that he wrote, "No university lecturer or anonymous BBC commentator has told the just and compassionate British people the truth about the women of San Martin de Val de Iglesias, for no greater crime than that they were found to possess some religious emblem, the women in San Martin de Val de Iglesias were condemned to be violated and to satiate every vile passion of 25 red militiamen each." That's a judicial sentence, and that's a Jewish court. "The fact that the fathers of some of the women had been imprisoned and were under sentence of death, and that their mothers were forced to be present to witness the degradation of their daughters, was not sufficient to dissuade the red militiamen from carrying out the sentence. The horrors of the hours suffered by these women had terrible effects on some of their minds. The survivors related how, again and again, they implored their executioners to kill them, rather than submit them to such dreadful dishonor. The appalling cruelty of such atrocities can be realized by the fact that many of the condemned women were married, and when they were conducted between militiamen before this pitiless tribunal, they carried children in their arms, and these children were witnesses of this culmination of the horror and the dishonor of their mothers. It is little wonder that the secret power directing the WRM said, communists should not be required to carry out their plan of terrorism in the localities in which they had lived with their families, but had to be used elsewhere." And that's the old Roman tactic of taking legions from the people that they conquered in one province and using those legions in another province.
I'd imagine if this kind of stuff happened in Israel, when the Syrians, Jordanians, Egyptians advanced in the various Arab-Israeli wars, if they massacred and raped and hacked Jews to death like this, we would see nonstop video after video, documentary after documentary, and there'd be books on it, and they'd have entire college courses built around it, wouldn't they?
24/7.
But we're never going to hear a peep out of this. And in fact, when I try and tell people about the atrocities communists have perpetrated, they call me a liar and they insult me.
And we'd have another 300 or 400 museums over here.
And the only thing that's preventing this from happening in America, the communists can't go door to door and massacre people because they take a lot of fire in the process and they don't want to die. So that's the only reason we haven't seen Bolshevik death squads going door to door. And largely, since they've won culturally, they don't need to push to the point where there's going to be blood in the streets.
Not yet, but they feel threatened at the slightest thing.
They're incredibly paranoid.
Absolutely. Well, people with a guilty conscience have to be paranoid. If you know that you're doing wrong, you have to be paranoid. This government knows that it's a tyranny, so it must be paranoid.
Well, of course, since they're plotting our destruction, they're always looking over their shoulder, wondering what happens if they find out we're plotting to destroy them. They may rise up and destroy us.
Well, no righteous government needs to be paranoid. And this government has become ever more increasingly paranoid of its own citizens.
Because it's a wicked, evil tyranny.
Absolutely. Righteous governments don't need to be paranoid. This government is no longer righteous. It ceased being righteous long ago, over 100 years ago. On another occasion, he said, young revolutionaries should start training for war immediately by means of practical operations such as liquidating a traitor, killing a spy, blowing up a police station, or robbing a bank to provide funds for the uprising. That's the same thing they did in Russia. Joseph Stalin was a bank robber, right? That's how he
bank
got
robber
his
and a train robber, and he spent the money with who knows how he spent the money. I imagine he spent a lot on himself, but he funneled a lot of it to Lenin. He was nothing other than a Jewish thug.
That's it. Every Israeli premier and prime minister has been nothing but a Jewish thug. That's how Jews that's how they advance their political careers.
A Jew with a gun is a criminal.
Do not shirk from these experimental attacks. They may, of course, degenerate into excesses, but that is a worry of the future. The communist Krasikov was a libertine who squandered party funds on riotous living. Lenin, when ordering his liquidation, said, "It does not matter to Comrade Krasikov has squandered party funds in a brothel, but it is scandalous that this should have disorganized the transportation of illegal literature." Communist training is designed to squeeze the last drop of human kindness out of the hearts of men and women who aspire to become high priests of the religion. Ann Parker rose to dizzy heights in the Soviet hierarchy. She became the foreign minister of Romania. She proved she was loyal to Stalin when she rendered herself a widow by denouncing the father of her three children as a Trotskyite.
All right, you want to know her birth name? Anna Parker was born Hannah Robinson.
Why do Jews change? Christians don't change their names.
Christians don't have anything to hide.
I've never met a Christian that changed his name.
And if they do, they maybe Americanize it. They drop a few letters here and there, or they change the vowel. But they're not going to. I asked my grandmother if she's ever known any Italian that changed their first, middle, and last name, and she said no. And my dad said no, and they both agreed only Jews do that.
Well, they may have, you know, the Poles and a lot of Italians, they changed the spelling slightly,
yeah,
simply to make it easier for the Anglos over here to understand.
Antonio might become Anthony.
But they don't change their names.
I mean, you've never seen anyone, you know, Brian become Murray. That doesn't happen with our people.
No.
Or Bill becomes Moshe.
No, that definitely isn't going to happen. Communist terrorists encourage mere boys to become executioners of the enemies of the proletariat in order to harden them and remove from their hearts every last vestige of human sentiment and sympathy. Sounds like the video game training our children receive. One such youth told how he had a lot of fun with the priest. He said, we have a lot of those youths today. He said, night after night we took him out with groups we had to kill, but always we put him last in the line. We made him wait while we killed all the others, and then we took him back to the Bellas Arts again. The Bellas Arts was the building of fine arts, which the communists used as a prison. Each night he thought the communists have no use for fine art. Each night he thought he was to die, but a quick death was too good for him. That frail died 7 deaths before we finally finished him. Mr. Knobloch, on page 87 of his book, Correspondent in Spain, tells of a horrible incident which confirms the contentions that the planners of world revolution select potential leaders while they are very young, Obama, Clinton, and train them until they are devoid of every trace of human sentiment and pity, Rhodes Scholars. Knobloch tells how 2 communist youths boasted to a doctor in his presence that they had mutilated and murdered 2 young priests. What's that secret society at Yale? They penetrated.
Bone and Bones. They call it the Order of Death.
That's the one. That's what. Well, that I'm thinking out loud to myself because this is everything that, you know, that happens here. These
and
secret
I've read
societies
about their,
do the same thing here that the communists that this man's describing.
I've read about their initiation rituals. Would you like me to discuss briefly what Skull and Bones does?
Sure, go ahead.
They make a member, an initiate, enter into a coffin. And while you're in the coffin, you have to gratify yourself while discussing all of your sexual exploits over your lifetime And then when you're done, you know, finishing what's going on, you emerge from the coffin and they declare you born again as one of their brethren, and then you're given a new name, a skull and bones name, a nickname, and they basically they stage mock murders, shouting basically long live death, the devil is death, the hangman is death, and then they drink out of skull shaped mugs.
And it's coaching people out of all morals.
It sounds to me like it's just a Jewish Baal worshiping cult. They're worshiping death.
Well, absolutely.
And weren't we told that some Israelites were admonished for making a covenant with death, and that their covenant would be nullified?
Absolutely. Knobloch tells how two communist youths boasted to a doctor in his presence that they had mutilated and murdered two young priests. They penetrated the disguise of these two religious men who, to escape detection and death, were working as coal heavers. The two youths told how they made the two priests dig their graves with their coal shovels. Then, in accordance with the communist-designed reign of terror, they emasculated their two victims and forced the organs into their mouths. They stood by jeering while the priests died slow, lingering deaths. De Fontires, in Red Terror in Madrid, pages 19 to 20, tells how the Chechas, organized by Dimitrov and Rosenberg, tried to make a certain lady tell where her husband was hiding. The woman probably did not know his whereabouts, but to make sure she didn't, the members of the Chechas made her sit and watch while they amused themselves piercing the breasts of eight women members of her household with long hatpins. To prove a previous statement that those who designed the pattern of the Reign of Terror used criminals and lunatics to stir up the bloodlust, I report what happened at Alcala on July 20th, 1936. The Reds released all the prisoners, both male and female, on condition that they would bear arms for the communist cause. They numbered 1,000 men and 200 women. They were formed into the Battalion of Alcala. They excelled themselves in the victorious attack on Madrid. As a reward, they were sent to Sigüenza. After taking over the town, they murdered 200 citizens to break down the resistance of the others. This battalion of criminals occupied Sigüenza for 16 weeks. When they were driven out by Franco's forces, it was found that every female from 10 to 50 had been violated. Many of them were pregnant and many diseased. Some were both. One girl, a waitress in a hotel, told how lucky she had been. She told how the criminals had murdered the Bishop of Sigüenza in the most horrible, barbarous, and unprintable manner. At a banquet held in a hotel that night, one of the battalion took a fancy to her and demanded that one of his comrades dress himself in the murdered bishop's vestments and marry them. The others thought this was a great joke and carried out the mock ceremony. After the wedding, the militiens performed the danse en ventre using the dining tables as a stage. After the orgy ended, the man claimed the girl as his own personal property. Relating this happening, she remarked, "I was lucky. My man was an assassin, but it was better to belong to him than to be the plaything of all. I at least escaped disease."
So much for Bolshevism liberating women.
Well, absolutely. That Bolshevism only wanted to liberate women from their husbands and fathers.
Exactly. Just like, you know, Satan promised Eve the world. He promised her that she would be as God. And what did she get? Mortality and death.
No doubt that that's been their plan all along, to destroy Christianity, ruin our women. They've done it. I mean, we've rolled over here without a revolution.
So they don't need to revolt to snatch up women in America, since we've just let them take them.
They have most of our women, and yes, we let them do it. We let them do it. We conditioned ourselves into letting them do it by swallowing their media and mass. Marcel M. Dutre published the fact that in Ciempozuelos, over 100 religious brothers were bound to lunatics who were then furnished with knives. One can imagine the horror which followed. Moscow's army of trained propagandists told the world how Franco's troops had murdered the mayors of many small towns, but they did not mention the fact that they had been tried by a properly constituted military court and proved to have been communist agents of Largo Caballero, who had plotted to turn Spain into a dictatorship. If further proof is needed to substantiate the statement that the secret powers behind a world revolutionary movement use communists throughout the world to further their totalitarian plans, the numerous desertions from the Communist Party all over the world should provide that proof. Douglas Hyde, who for the preceding 5 years was news editor of the Daily Worker, Britain's leading communist newspaper, in March 1948 announced his resignation from the Communist Party. In a press release, he stated, "I believe that the new line of the Communist Party introduced after the formation of the Cominform last year, which was 1947, if successful, will bring nothing but misery to the common people." When did communism bring anything besides misery to the common
people? Well, it's the typical lie of Satan, as we said about Eve. Promise immortality, promise a paradise. Communists promised to bring about basically a paradise kingdom that will never end, but instead they plunge the world into misery. Isn't that what one of the Jews said? He said that he was basically criticizing his own people. He said they promised to bring about a paradise, but instead they deliver hell.
Mr. Hyde went on to explain that since the end of World War II, he had been worried regarding Moscow's foreign policy. He said he had finally become convinced that the party line, as now determined by the Moscow clique, was no longer in keeping with the ideals for which he had worked so long, and that the ultimate result would be to destroy the very freedoms and decencies for which the communists had been fighting for so long a time. Freedoms and decencies. This man was absolutely deluded. He concluded with these words, quote, "My growing disillusionment led me to seek some other answer to the problem of our day and another way out of the world of chaos." I think fascism would have been the right choice.
Well, that's why Mussolini went from socialism to fascism. He grew up and he opened his eyes.
Absolutely. Right on top of Mr. Hyde's resignation in London, England, came that of Mrs. Justina Krusenstern-Peters, a staff member of Soviet publications for the preceding 12 years. She announced her resignation in Shanghai, China. She said, "The strain of writing according to orders from Moscow became more than I could bear. I am still a Soviet citizen. I am sure my feelings are shared by many of my colleagues in Russia. The only difference is that they are not able to protest against their enslavement. Most communists," so she sounds like a disillusioned Jew, "most communists work to bring about an international of Soviet socialist republics. In other words, they feel that only by using revolutionary methods can they speedily destroy the stranglehold of selfish capitalism and place political power in the hands of the workers." The problem, the biggest problem here is the confusion of capitalism and free enterprise.
Yes.
Few party members realize they are working themselves into a state of slavery from which there is no hope of escape. And that's the end of William Guy Carr's section on the Spanish Civil War.
All right, where would you like to go from here?
Well, I'd like to discuss this. It's on my Mein Kampf site. I stole it from the New York Times website. I had to have it. It's an article that was in the New York Times not too long ago, celebrating the museum display in memory of the Spanish Civil War. And I'd actually, I don't know if you're in a position to read it, because I'm getting a little hoarse here.
All right, where do I pull it up at?
Well,
want to begin and then just send me a link and I'll start?
Yeah, I'm trying to send you a link right now, but my browser doesn't want to cooperate. I actually Skyped it to you before the show, but that's okay. This article appeared in the New York Times, and it's on the New York Times website. It's also on my Mein Kampf site. It's under the discussion section. The menu item is Spanish Civil War, and it's Modern Communist Propaganda, Example 3. The New York Times is a communist rag. That's my title for the article. It has a picture of what looks like either Coney Island or Jones Beach in New York City. It could be down to Jersey Shore, but I doubt it. It looks like Coney Island or Jones Beach. And it has a biplane flying over a very crowded beach, and it's carrying a banner, "Bring home wounded Americans from Spain." And I can't, there's more to the banner, but it's cut out in the picture.
That's ridiculous.
It was cut out in the picture. You know, the picture I have it is the original picture that appeared on the New York Times website.
I've seen documentaries where these people are lauded as heroes. They were the first to fight fascism.
Well, that's the point of this article. The point of my wanting to elucidate this article is to show that, as we just discussed, it was Russian, or I should say Jewish, Soviet Bolshevism behind that caused the entire Spanish Civil War. And the New York Times is promoting these people who went over there to fight on the side of the Bolsheviks as heroes. To this day, they're promoting this. And this is very representative of most of the articles that I found on the internet concerning the Spanish Civil War.
And I have to wonder, how were these people wounded in Spain? Were they attacked when they were trying to rape nuns? They were shot in self-defense? Bring home wounded Americans from Spain. They should bring them home in bags or bring them home to try them.
No doubt.
No, I have a book that's called Fabric of Terror, 3 Days in Angola by Bernardo Teixeira. He's a Portuguese who was in Angola discussing what happened on March 15, 1961, when communist blacks came out of the Congo and chopped people up with machetes, ran them through sawmill blades, crucified them, hacked off limbs, hacked off breasts from women, gang raped people. And the level of violence that accompanied the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and Spain, it seems to be almost Negro-style violence that is typically more at home in Africa. It's not something that you would expect would come from the mind of a Spaniard or a Russian.
It only comes from the mind of a Jew.
A minion of Satan.
Listen to some of the piercing, this torturing this woman by piercing her servant's breasts with pins, and putting this priest on the back of a line to be executed 7 times, and not killing him. That's probably worse than dying, right?
And yet they complain, the ACLU complains, that one black man, they failed to execute him in Ohio because they couldn't find a vein. They tried for half an hour, and they said since they've already tried to execute him, they can't do it again because he was under a lot of stress the first time. And they said that after one failed attempt, not knowing if you're going to die the second time or if it'll have to be a third time, they said that that's too much for the man to bear, and they should pardon him or at least commute his sentence.
Well, that is a
Negro rapist killer.
That is, as William Guy Carr just explained, the pattern of the Bolsheviks, of the enemy, the enemies of Christianity. Their pattern is to protect, elevate, and liberate the criminal elements in society so that they could use them against society as their ultimate goal.
And then, of course, they'll kill them in the end.
Well, of course, once they take control.
All right, then. Shall I begin reading this article?
Yes, be my guest.
If there are any doubts about the deep longing we have to believe in heroes, to discover those with superior courage, vision, and commitment, and then to celebrate their accomplishments, the new exhibition at the Museum of the City of New York should put those doubts to rest. Quote, "Facing Fascism, New York and the Spanish Civil War," quote, which opened yesterday, is in full celebration mode, and why not? According to the show's interpretation of that bloody conflict in the mid-1930s, which pitted political virtue against fascistic evil, the group of New Yorkers it focuses on, whose best-known members became famous as the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, were heroes indeed. They were heroes first, the exhibition suggests, because they were among the 3,000 or so United States citizens, about a third from New York City, who defied their government's prohibition and secretly went to Spain in 1937 to fight the forces of fascism. Some 800 lost their lives in an international brigade formed to help defend Spain's Republican government against Franco's rebels aided by Germany and Italy. They were also heroes, the show implies, because they saw what others did not. The Spanish Republic fell in April 1939, and World War II began soon after, partly because these prescient fighters and their political allies had not been heeded. Western democratic leaders instead maintained neutrality during the Spanish Civil War. The Soviet Union did not, becoming the main supplier of men and materiel for the Republic, seemingly trying to head off catastrophe. Head off catastrophe? They were there organizing massacres.
It seems to me that the Jews in power here probably couldn't influence the masses of the people to sign on to a war against Franco, because Franco's no threat to the rest of the world. Spain's no threat to the rest of the world. Where Hitler, they convinced everybody, and even William Guy Carr, is, I'm going to make a statement at the end of the program, that Hitler was out to destroy and subject the entire world. And the Jews managed to convince people of that concerning Hitler. They could have never have convinced people that Franco was a threat to America.
What would Franco conquer the world with, four ships?
Well, right. Well, that's my point. So they would never, knowing that they would never rally the people to get into a war against the Christians of Spain, I'll call them. I won't call them the fascists, because the New York Times, they know they're lying. That they would never convince the people in this country to persuade them to that. So they had to stay neutral. They had to stay neutral, otherwise I think they would reveal their real plans.
Absolutely. All right. These New Yorkers were heroes too, we are meant to think, because they continued to fight against fascism even after their return home. In a series of video interviews, one veteran argues, presumably in the 1980s, that what happened in Spain was no different from what was happening in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and South Africa. Another asserts that the United States in Vietnam was doing just what Hitler and Mussolini did. And I'm sure that they say a third were from New York. My guess is more than half were Jews, or useful idiots that have been brainwashed thoroughly by the Jews. For their moral vision, the exhibition also suggests these heroic figures paid yet another price. They were persecuted as loyal members of the Communist Party. One object here is a collection can labeled Save a Spanish Republic Child that belonged to Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, a piece of evidence introduced against them when they were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage. A vague impression is left that both the accusations and the evidence of party involvement were frivolous compared to the couple's virtuous intentions. Hmm. Has a Jew ever had virtuous intentions?
Oh, all the time, if you listen to their media. And,
yeah,
and they're rabbis. I mean,
they're all socialites and philanthropists, aren't they?
The problem with Christians is that we don't read the Talmud.
Actually, this show, which is a collaborative effort between the museum, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, Instituto Cervantes New York, and Tamimente Library at New York University, deviates little from what would have once been called the party line. Its story is told in black strips that are meant to suggest the unfolding of newsreels, the design echoing at times the placards of protest marchers. Freestanding biographical pillars of memorabilia stand like memorials to martyrs. Perry Rosenstein, the president of the Pufin Foundation, the main sponsor of the exhibition, writes of these fighters, "They represented the best of our country and the best of our conscience." Seems like a typical Jew thinking his people over there massacring priests and raping nuns to death somehow are the moral compass of the world.
Well, that's what the Jew would think. I mean, that's exactly what the Jew should think.
That's what
I would expect Satan to think.
Did they? The real situation is far more complicated than anything suggested here. Some essays in an accompanying catalog published by the Museum and New York University Press hint at other directions the show might have taken, including taking notes of the distinctive New York intellectual life that developed on the left, partly in opposition to these ideas. Instead, the curators, Sarah M. Henry and Thomas Mellons, are so focused on the virtues of the fighters that the exhibition seems like an attempt to rehabilitate the communist left after decades in which historical research and opened Soviet archives have revealed how much darker the Spanish conflict was than the party interpretation ever let on.
Now, here they're admitting they're communists,
mm-hmm.
but in the first paragraph, they're calling them heroes.
In this attempt to reestablish the Civil War as a morality tale, the show is not alone. In February, for example, in The Guardian of London, the historian Eric Hobsbawm celebrated the ultimate triumph of the war's losers and suggested that the virtues of their cause transcended Stalin's machinations. The recent film Pan's Labyrinth portrays populist forest-dwelling partisans confronting a monstrously evil fascist leader. In June, W.W. Norton is going to release the latest edition of Paul Preston's much-hailed history, The Spanish Civil War, Reaction, Revolution, and Revenge, which blames, quote, an unholy alliance of anarchists, Trotskyists, and Cold Warriors, quote, for obscuring the nature of war against Spanish fascism. And that's just, that's all half-truths and obfuscation, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Mr. Preston goes out of his way to justify and explain the Soviet position, dismissing revisionists who, quote, resuscitate the basic theses of Francoist propaganda, end quote. So he sounds like a Stalinist apologist trying to blame all the problems on anarchists and Trotskyites. Satan's kingdom is divided against itself. Quote, the most that Stalin wished for the Republic, Mr. Preston writes, continuing on, was that there might be a compromise solution acceptable to the Western democracies, end quote. Stalin wasn't looking to compromise the Western democracies. He was looking to undermine them and dominate the world.
Who could ever believe that Stalin, who killed millions of his own people to secure his totalitarian position, would compromise with the Western democracy?
He hated them.
Absolutely. This Mr. Preston is nobody could be that stupid. I can't imagine. He has to be purposely lying.
His birth name's probably not Paul Preston.
No, it's probably Paul Rosenstein or something.
The Soviet vision of the war, of course, has the appeal of both simplicity and partial accuracy. Franco was indeed a ruthless tyrant whose victory led to wide-scale purges, cruel imprisonments, and extensive constraints. No, no, and no. We've already shown that's not the case.
Well, if the cruel imprisonments were of the people who were raping the nuns and killing the priests,
so what?
And if the wide-scale purges were of the people who were violating 10-year-olds 25 times per man, and
they deserve to be purged.
Well, they absolutely deserve to be purged. And we've seen that Franco was a patriotic Christian general who came to the defense of a democratic republic, if I have to call it that, that he wasn't even in favor of. Yeah, you know, he was a traditional monarchist, and the country voted this democratic government, and the king left, and most of the traditional Catholics accepted that. What they did not accept was the Bolshevik agitation and the plans for Bolshevik overthrow of the liberal government that they helped get elected in.
And, you know, what was I about to say here?
So yeah, even though Franco didn't like the National Front, the Republican government, he was still, they sought to defend it. That's what they were defending against the Bolsheviks that wanted to overthrow it.
I've been on your Wikipedia looking up the names, the birth dates, and the death years of all these revolutionaries, these Soviet agents, these Spanish useful idiots, and these collaborators. Most of the ones that didn't flee Spain died in Spain in the 50s, 60s, or 70s when Franco was still very much alive and in power. So if these leaders were dying in Spain in their homes in the 60s, how could he have been a bloodthirsty tyrant? Wouldn't he have killed them within a week of coming to power?
Absolutely.
You know, when Jews come to power, the heads roll, as you've often said. It seems when genuine white people are in power and they put down a crazed Jewish bloodthirsty revolt, there aren't that many purges. The people that have blood on their hands are dead. The people that violated children are dead, and rightly so. But like the Tsar in 1905, he would have been more than justified in bathing in the blood of those Jewish revolutionaries. But most of them lived to tell, you know, they lived to tell the tale, didn't they?
Well, sadly, what most white people do, well, when there's a problem, and we know the Jews are behind it, but you know, the government won't recognize that, is they have a 9/11 committee, and they find that the mainstream media story about 11 ragtag Arabs taking over our airports and crashing all our planes, that's actually true. that the Mossad had nothing to do with it after all.
The Western democracies were indeed slow to recognize Hitler's threat, and without Soviet assistance, the Republic would have foundered sooner. What might have happened had the Republic been defended with a real international force? Well, I imagine if American soldiers were over there and saw what was going on, they would have massacred all the Republicans and sided with Hitler and Mussolini. That's probably why no American soldiers were sent there. If Rosenfeld said you're going to go over there and make the world safe for democracy, and they went over there and saw the communist militia members...
Well, that's why I think they would have jeopardized their plans for World War II if they'd have interfered in Spain. I really believe that.
That's why they didn't want to get sidetracked, and they didn't want to end up, you know, with a small breakfast when they were waiting for dinner. But look more closely and the formulas don't fit. Was Franco's Spain really an arm of what was later called international fascism? And I'd like to discuss this term real quick. There's really no such thing as international fascism. Mussolini said that the working classes are bound to their native shores, and Hitler said national socialism is not for export. Fascism's never been international.
No. No, there were other, you know, groups that wanted to institute Oswald Mosley in Britain.
They were inspired by Mussolini and Hitler, but they weren't beholden to them.
Absolutely. And Hitler really didn't...
He didn't want to deal with them.
He didn't want to deal with those people at all. He wasn't concerned with anything outside of Germany.
No.
He was only concerned with the fate and future of the German people.
The Communist Party in America, they took their marching orders from Moscow. Spain was neutral during World War II, and the Führer wasn't interested in Franco's late offer of support. Moreover, Franco's tyrannical vision never came up to the standards set by Hitler's mad plans or Stalin's demonic enterprise, which is one reason Spain could easily slip into democracy after Franco's death. The Civil War, in fact, had more to do with Spain than with fascism. Hugh Thomas's encyclopedic Spanish Civil War reveals stupefying patterns of legislative failure and manic enterprise in the years before the war. Spain had no strong democratic traditions or middle class. It was an anomaly, a European nation that even World War I had passed by. Its agrarian, pre-industrial stagnation accompanied by rigid social hierarchies and strong regional allegiances. When a republic was established in 1931, it proved as vulnerable to revolutionary extremism as conservative reaction. Land reform could mean land seizure. Church reform could mean violence. Anarchism, riots, and rebellion were familiar companions of the republic's bumbling modernity. And we already addressed this issue, that they had established it intending it to be a bumbling failure from day one so they could bring order out of the chaos. They wanted to plunge the nation into anarchy, massacre 10 million people in the ensuing violence, and then establish a Bolshevik tyranny at the end of it all. Isn't that their typical blueprint?
Well, absolutely. I mean, they set the same patterns over and over. There's no doubt.
What role, then, did the Soviet Union play once the military rebellion had begun? Invited in by the weak left-wing government, it began a methodical attempt to place its agents at central points of control. In October 1936, André Marté, the Comintern leader skewered by Ernest Hemingway and for whom the bell tolls, spoke about first using the Spanish anarchists to win. After victory, we will get even with them. They weren't invited in after the fact. They were well in place for years. This revolution had to be 10 years in the making. What do you think?
Well, it was in the making at least since 1931 when they got the monarchy out.
Probably 5 or 6 years before that, they were working on getting the monarchy out of step one. They had to be in Spain since the mid-20s.
Well, that's very plausible.
But definitely, like you said, since 1931. So they weren't coming in after the fact. Oh, Franco's risen up to crush our communist comrades in Spain. We better send some people there. They were already there. They'd been there for years.
Well, there's no doubt that there weren't Bolshevik elements in the country lobbying and working towards the election of a left-wing government.
Mm-hmm.
That there's no doubt about that at all. And as soon as they got that left-wing government elected and they got the king to abdicate, that was their, like we discussed before, that was their Kerensky government in Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And they sought to overthrow the government that they wanted to get elected in order to effect an entirely totalitarian communist state.
The abdication of the monarch was basically just the opening salvo for them, wasn't it?
Absolutely. The election of the Popular Front government and the abdication of Alfonso what was only the opening salvo.
Same
and that was the first step, just like the Tsar allowed the Kerensky government to exist. That was the first step in the complete Bolshevization of Spain.
All right.
And Franco stopped it. One Spanish general stopped it. They hate him for it. They've demonized him ever since.
The same with Hitler and Mussolini and Salazar to a lesser extent. You know, after the massacres in Angola, Kennedy told Salazar, you should quit Angola. And Salazar said, we will not abandon Angola to terrorists. And they hung on for another 14 years in Angola. But obviously the CIA had to have had involvement. In fact, the leader of the Angolan, they call them partisans, freedom fighters, I'll just call them terrorists and maniacs, Holden Roberto, he met with Kennedy and some other American officials about a few months before the attack. He had tea with Eleanor Rosenfeld. And then after the attack, somebody asked him, is it true you massacred women and children? And he said, yes, there's no sense denying it. This time the slaves did not cower. They killed everything. And then the reporter said, women and children too? And he said, yes. Then he asked one of his lieutenants, how can you run someone through a sawmill blade? And the man smiled and said, lengthwise. So these are the kind of people that they roll out the red rug for here in America, the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Well, it's no secret. I mean, they do it all the time. They
out
trumpet,
there.
They trumpet this type of people in the media all the time.
For those who are willing to receive it, it is out there.
Yes, there's no secret. The only secret is that the American people don't wake up to it and don't actually examine it.
Because they're stupid and ignorant and apathetic. They just don't care.
Well, it's that party-hardy society that we've had for the last 120 years.
Well, caring about American tax dollars being used to massacre people around the world, that might require that they turn off the TV and get off the couch and go outside and do something. Heaven forbid they have to pick up a rifle and take back their country.
Well, that's never going to happen. That's never going to happen. And when the average American is not going to wake up until there is no more TV, there is no more rifle, there is no more six-pack, and there is no more football.
There's only a gulag.
Yes.
And then it'll be too late to wake up.
Well, that's, you know, we can't fight our way out of this, and we can't vote our way out of it. We have to repent first as a people.
A wicked, sinful people that doesn't even recognize sin anymore, how can they repent their way out of anything?
No matter how Babylon falls and no matter what solution we have at the end of the road, we get nowhere without repentance first.
Absolutely. But I think it's gotten so bad that our people can't even blush anymore.
Well, it would be awfully difficult for most of them, too.
All right. The same year, Pravda spoke of victory as well, then of cleaning up Spain, quote, with the same energy as in the USSR, quote. Stalin opposed those in Spain who called for revolution. He wanted control. By 1937, after the show trials in Moscow, it was apparent to many devoted idealists that the party's high moral proclamations were not what they seemed. This is what George Orwell fitfully recognizes in his Homage to Catalonia. First, he fights in an independent Marxist division that was apparently kept deliberately undersupplied. Later, he fears for his life in Barcelona, Republican-held territory, as the party begins a planned purge, including killings and torture. Some recent research has suggested that even members of the Lincoln Brigade, some of whom disappeared, were not immune. Quote, as for the newspaper talk about this being a war for democracy, Orwell wrote, it was plain eyewash. No one in his senses supposed that there was any hope of democracy, end quote. None of this can be learned from the show, and to all of it, our heroes of the Lincoln Brigade were blind, or worse. The Hitler-Stalin pact, which followed Franco's victory by a few months, also hardly seemed to have affected their allegiances. Last week, the New York Sun, Ronald Radosh, author of Spain Betrayed, the Soviet Union and the Spanish Civil War, quoted a speech by Milton Wolf, one of the exhibition's Lincoln fighters, they should call him a Lincoln rapist, made in 1941 while the pact was still in effect. For Wolf, Franklin Rosenfeld had become the nascent fascist menace. No Lincoln brigades would be needed against Hitler. We fight, he proclaimed, quote, against the involvement of our country in an imperialist war, end quote. But he fought for a Soviet imperialist war in Spain. And I'm sure while he was over there, he raped more than his share of nuns. Orwell said that no one could spend, quote, more than a few weeks in Spain without being in some degree disillusioned, end quote. Thank goodness we still have heroes. And then it says here, give to build, homes for the children, hospitals for the wounded of Spain, trade union relief for Spain, send contributions to David Dubinsky, treasurer, 3 West 16th Street, New York City.
Is he Polish, David Dubinsky?
David Dubinsky. My
somehow
guess is,
I don't think he's Polish.
How many homes were built for the children?
Let me say that before we discuss these pictures, because I'd like to discuss them at length. The this article, it Stalin's evil, but only because he made an alliance with Hitler. That's the only reason why Stalin's bad in this article, it seems to me.
So Stalin's not bad for killing possibly 60 million of his own people. He's bad for casting his lot in with Hitler temporarily.
Well, exactly. That's what it appears to me that they're saying. And the role of the USSR in this is absolutely minimized. And these people that fought in this Abraham Lincoln Brigade are still heroes to the New York Times. They are still singing a romantic song about these people who fought for communism.
And most of them were Jews and communists or useful idiot Negroes.
Well, there's no doubt. And this is the flavor of most of the material on the internet today about the Spanish Civil War, even from what you would consider conservative sites. That they're just totally misinformed about the Spanish Civil War. And they're totally misinformed about Hitler. And I would like to say that even William Guy Carr, he did a lot of good in a lot of areas, but he really drops the ball with Adolf Hitler, because he takes the Jewish media position that Adolf Hitler was out to destroy, to conquer the world. And he basically has the attitude that if Hitler had won, we'd be speaking German today.
Well, we're going to be speaking Yiddish pretty soon, it seems.
Well, absolutely. A mixture between Yiddish and hip-hop. How hideous.
Bastardized Spanish.
Ebonics. Okay, so that, you know, Carr fails there, but he did an excellent job on the Spanish Civil War, I believe. These pictures that the New York Times of people that fought for the Spanish side that the New York Times celebrates, and people who worked for the Spanish cause that the New York Times celebrates. First is there's the trade union relief for Spain poster you were just discussing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where this Jew is collecting money for homes for the children and hospitals for the wounded of Spain. So I'm sure not much of that money actually reached Spain. I'm
sure it all reached the Jews' pocket.
Well, yeah, that's what Jews do. That they create charities so that they can make comfortable livings for themselves and for other Jews. But the second picture is a picture of Langston Hughes and volunteer Edwin Rolf in Spain, yucking it up, circa 1938. Now, these are the people the New York Times is celebrating as heroes.
Would you like to discuss who Langston Hughes is?
Yes. James Mercer Langston Hughes. What an Anglo-sounding name, all four of them. Lived from February 1st, 1902 to May 22nd, 1967. He was an American poet, novelist, playwright, short story writer, and columnist. He was one of the earliest innovators of the new literary form, art form, called jazz poetry. So I would think that Langston Hughes was probably the real father of modern hip-hop, right?
So jazz poetry, is that where you do the beatnik, and you tap on a drum a few times and say two or three words, you tap again and say two or three more?
Just like rap. That's what I would think. He's the real father of rap. That's what it sounds like to me. Now, Hughes is best known for his work during the Harlem Renaissance. He famously wrote about the Harlem Renaissance, saying that Harlem was in vogue. Now let me show the kind of people that the New York Times loves. Ancestry and childhood. Langston Hughes was born in Joplin, Missouri, the second child of school teacher Carrie Mercer Langston and her husband James Nathaniel Hughes. Both parents were mixed race, And Langston Hughes was of African-American, European-American, and Native American descent. They missed the Jewish, but it'll come out in a minute. He grew up in a series of Midwestern small towns. Both his paternal grandmothers were African-American, and both his paternal great-grandfathers were white, one of whom was Scottish and one of whom was of Jewish descent.
Well, then they both can't be white.
Well, that's absolutely true, but
according to your Wikipedia, though, Jews are white.
According to the New York Times and according to Jews, Jews are white. That way they could do all the evil in the world in the name of white people.
And blame us.
All white people appear to be evil.
But when they don't have to be white anymore, they suddenly become Israelis, they become ethnically Jewish, they become Turks, they become whatever else they need to become. Once they're done dragging our name, the name of our race, through the mud, and they don't want to deal with the flack that comes at white people.
Right. Okay, Hughes was named after both his father and his great-uncle, John Mercer Langston, who in 1888 became the first black to be elected to the United States Congress from Virginia. Hughes' maternal grandmother, Mary Patterson, was of African-American, French, English, and Native American descent, one of the first women to attend Oberlin College. She first married Lewis Sheridan Leary, also of mixed race. He joined the men in John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859 and died from his wounds. In 1869, Mary Patterson Leary married again into the elite, politically active Langston family. Her second husband was Charles Henry Langston of African-American, Native American, and Euro-American ancestry. He and his younger brother, John Mercer Langston, worked for the abolitionist cause and helped lead the Ohio Anti-Slavery Society in 1858.
That sounds like a too bad organization.
Charles Langston later moved to Kansas, where he was active as an educator and activist for voting rights for African Americans. Charles and Mary's daughter, Carolyn Mercer Langston, was the mother of Langston Hughes.
Phil,
yes.
I'd like to get into the abolition movement and show how it was basically just a revolutionary Jewish movement, since I think that that was basically the opening salvo in this country against the white civilization and white Christian tradition. They basically usurped and used Christianity as a mechanism for advancing miscegenation. Would you agree that the abolitionists, the people that say the Negro is your brother, he shouldn't be held in slavery, but they don't stop there. They say pick up a gun and go down south and kill a white Southerner. That's just Jewish revolutionaries.
Well, that's exactly what it was, and they were infiltrated at a very early time, the Christian churches in the Northeast. There's no doubt. In fact, I would think that they were infiltrated by the end of the 17th century, when Cotton Mather convinced the other New England preachers that usury was good.
Mm-hmm. So he was either a Jew or beholden to the Jews. They probably paid him off.
And that's why we've heard so much of Cotton Mather throughout history, was because he did the work of Satan. He did the work of the devil. That's my personal opinion. They keep their Goyim slave famous. That they keep them in the limelight. That they put them on pedestals so that they could corrupt future generations by saying, well, Cotton Mather said it's all right, and that's just an example.
Well, who the hell cares? Satan said it's all right to do this and that. Yahweh said don't do it. So who are you going to listen to?
Well, right. But it was Cotton Mather to convince the preachers of New England that usury was good. And
they always do that. They find someone that tells them what they want to hear, and they say, well, so-and-so, who we respect as an authority, he said we can do it. Well, you know, who are you going to listen to, the commandments of God or the traditions of man?
Well, absolutely. And my point in going over the Langston Hughes biography is to show that this family, through several generations, many generations, was active in all of the anti-Christian activist causes.
Mm-hmm.
Right up
satanic.
Through the Spanish Civil War.
Well, I would think their background, with this kind of background, they're all mongrels and lawless brute beasts. They have to be involved in this kind of nonsense.
They are, and they're always financed to do these things. They're able in every generation. They don't. The family has no real source of wealth. I mean, a school teacher in the 1800s is not a source of wealth.
And this guy's writing poetry, and he's a columnist. Translation, he doesn't do any real work.
But somehow they're able, generation after generation, to attend these colleges and universities and to get involved in all of these activist causes. How is that? If they're not financed from outside, how is that? How could they do that? It's certainly not apparent. I mean, it's not that they could do this. There must be a guiding force, is what I'm trying to say, that has actually enabled families like this. And there's a lot of families like this. And another Langston Hughes is the heroes of the New York Times' Spanish Civil War. Langston Hughes is pictured with Edwin Rolfe, a volunteer in Spain. And Edwin Rolfe is the son of Russian immigrants, born in Philadelphia in 1909. His father was a shoemaker, but he was an active trade unionist and a member of the Socialist Party of America. His mother was a friend of Margaret Sanger, which this website says was an advocate of women's rights. She was actually the queen of Planned Parenthood, eugenics, and abortion rights in America.
She was friends with Stoddard. They got along on a minor level due to their mutual respect for eugenics, but I think she had to be a shill and a Jew whore for promoting abortion, contraception, and the fact that basically she hated motherhood. And that's just not normal.
Well, absolutely. Now, Edwin Rolfe's real name was originally Solomon Fishman.
Mm.
As a teenager, he joined the American Communist Party. He contributed cartoons, poems, and book reviews to the Daily Worker communist newspaper. He reported on a case of Vanzetti and Sacco, Sacco and Vanzetti for the newspaper. In 1929, he became a student at the University of Wisconsin. He then moved to New York and once again became active in politics. These are the people that the New York Times regards as heroes, and this is the type of people that went and joined the Abraham Lincoln Brigade to go to fight on the side of the Bolsheviks in the Spanish Civil War. And the Jewish media regards them as heroes today. Another person pictured in this New York Times article is one of your favorites.
Who?
Paul Robeson. Tell us about Paul Robeson.
Okay, I'll tell you about Paul Robeson. Let me just pull up the wiki. But I will tell you that he is famous as a Negro singer. He went to the Soviet Union. He was there for probably a decade or more. And I'm on your Wikipedia. Born Paul Leroy Bustill Robeson, April 9, 1898. Died in January 1976. He sang the most famous and well-known English language version of the Soviet national anthem. He won the Lenin Peace Prize, the Stalin Peace Prize, and I believe he was declared a hero of socialist labor, although don't quote me on that last one. I'm going to have to look for that, but I see right here he is listed loudly and proudly on your Wikipedia as a Stalin Peace Prize recipient, and now they are naming high schools around the country after him. There is a Paul Robeson High School, I believe, in Chicago, and another one in Philadelphia, and I read that one of them, 50% of all the girls are pregnant, and it's a 98% black school, and they have a graduation rate of around 15%.
And how many of those graduates can read?
I'm sure Paul Robeson would be proud.
Well, that's just the type of people that the New York Times applauds as heroes for fighting or for supporting the Bolsheviks in the Spanish Civil War.
And here's what he said. The allies of fascism who want to destroy the new democracies of the world, let's not get confused. They are the enemies of the working class. Would you give civil rights to the Ku Klux Klan? He was denouncing Trotskyists. When he was over in the Soviet Union, a lot of American Negroes and other American communists had moved to the Soviet Union claiming it was the only free country in the world. There were probably 10 or 20,000 American communists there in the 30s, and Stalin became paranoid against them and started purging them. While he was over there, some American communists tried to whisper to him and pass him notes saying, get in contact with an American consular official for us. We need to get out of here. Stalin's crazy. Help us. And he turned over all the notes to Stalin, and he denounced them. And he never said a word when he came back to the States. He talked about how great things were over there and how they were all happy.
Absolutely incredible. It's the only thing that explains any of this is two seed line Christian identity. The only thing that, and our belief says, the only thing that could possibly explain the forces behind world events in the last couple hundred years.
He also was an apologist for Stalin when Stalin allied with Germany. He said, quote, "To collaborate with the Soviet Union in a real policy of collective security," that France had forced the Soviets to do that. When he said that France and Britain would not ally with the Soviets, they forced them to ally with the Germans, and they had no choice. So he said that it was fine. He said that an Anglo-Russian pact would have stopped Nazi aggression, but they didn't have such a pact, so Stalin had no choice. When somebody asked him about Stalin murdering millions in the Soviet Union, he said, "I have told you, mister, that I would not discuss anything with the people who have murdered 60 million of my people, and I will not discuss Stalin with you." He said, "And I will discuss Stalin when I may be among the Russian people someday singing for them. I will discuss it there. It is their problem." Asked if he had praised Stalin during his previous trip to the Soviet Union, Robeson replied, "I do not know." When asked outright if he had changed his mind about Stalin, he implored, "Whatever has happened to Stalin, gentlemen, is a question for the Soviet Union, and I would not argue with a representative of the people who, in building America, wasted 60 to 100 million lives of my people, black people drawn from Africa, on the plantations. You are responsible and your forebears for 60 million to 100 million black people dying in the slave ships and on the plantations, and don't ask me about anybody, please." That was after Stalin's murder. I don't remember 100 million black people being killed in slavery. I thought it was, what, maybe 4 to 5 million at most were enslaved and maybe half died. Where's he getting 100 million? There weren't even 100 million blacks in the entire world.
What he is doing is he's spewing the garbage that Satan poured into his brain.
And what is that? And even if 100 million blacks died 300 years ago, how does that take away from Stalin killing 60 million people yesterday? And the killings are still ongoing. It changes nothing. It doesn't
alter.
Well,
he killed 60 million white Christians, so I guess that's all right. And Paul Robeson's proven to be just another hypocrite, but they all are.
He's just a house nigger. He's an Uncle Tom for Stalin, isn't he?
Absolutely.
And I'm sure Stalin would have killed him if he settled in the Soviet Union and started speaking out against him.
Well, you know, I think that people like Paul Robeson and Langston Hughes are trumpeted as heroes to attract black men into those persuasions.
Mm-hmm.
To create more enemies of the white Christian in America. And of course, that didn't really take off. But, I mean, now today they have gangster rap to do that.
Well, blacks don't want to hear about the Booker T. Washington or Du Bois, go to college and make something of yourself. They'd rather hear, you know, dance around, grab your crotch, aim a gun sideways, cap somebody, and then get some white hoe.
Well, right. And gangster rap is the perfect tool that the Jews have developed to leverage the black youth in the cities against white society. There's
exactly.
No
doubt. And I think a lot of Jews are starting to retreat to the countryside now. A lot of them are moving to Colorado, Wyoming, Idaho. They want to get away from the cities because they know that they've basically lit the fuse. And the fuse is burning and the powder keg's going to explode at some point in the near future. And the blacks look at them as white and they don't want to be massacred. Since a lot of Jews are viewed by blacks as just super whites with a lot more cash than regular whites.
Well, in Jersey, I mean, there's still a lot of Jews in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, but in Jersey, they fled to the suburbs from places like Newark and Jersey City back in the 80s, 70s and 80s, they fled to the suburbs.
Absolutely. They want no part of it. They start a revolution, or they cultivate the conditions and circumstances necessary for a revolution, but they generally don't stick around for the revolution. A few stick around as commissars, but the great majority don't want to be there because they're liable to get caught up in the revolution and they don't want to die.
Well, right. They want to survive their own revolution, create their own hell.
Mm-hmm. They want to create a hell on earth. And Hitler tried to create a heaven on earth, and that's why they killed him.
Well, next week I would like to discuss the Jewish role in the French Revolution, the Masonic
Absolutely.
Role in the French Revolution.
All right, I know the general themes, but I will need you to send me the specific material so I can become versed in it.
Well, right, I'm going to be drawing mostly from Nesto Webster, and I'll send it to
you. Okay, excellent. All right, so that's it on the Spanish civil war, or more properly termed the Bolshevik Revolution in Spain, we've proven that Franco was not this bloodthirsty tyrant. He was simply a patriot who, even though a traditional Catholic monarchist, was willing to defend a decadent, democratically elected government that he perceived as under attack by anarchists. I don't know if he understood that the anarchists basically dominated the government and were toppling it to bring in Bolshevik tyranny. He had one other general out of 23, two generals out of 23 that had not knelt before the altar of the Grand Orient Lodge and taken the Masonic Oath. But when the generals found out that Spain was being betrayed and ruined, most of them rallied to the side of the Spanish people since they did not want to massacre their countrymen. The world has been shown this vision of history that Franco was this mass murdering tyrant and he was a stooge for Hitler, but Franco was definitely independent of Hitler in ideology and in thought. Spain did not become an ally of Germany. The Bolsheviks had been active in Spain for over a decade, and they were seeking to make Spain just basically the westernmost province of the Soviet Union.
And Franco represented Christian traditionalism, even though it was mostly Catholic traditionalism. It's still to some extent, to a small extent, Christian. It's still Christian, and it's still moral, and that's, you know, those traditionalists that Franco represented, the minority were fascists. It was the American media that labels them all fascists.
Yeah.
But we see today on the streets of Tel Aviv and on the streets of New York City, Christians are synonymous and wear the tag of fascists out of the mouth of the Jews. The Jews consistently consider Christians to be fascists. And they spout that epithet towards Christians all the time. Fascists and Nazis.
And you would agree, had it not been for Franco, Spain would have been the westernmost province of the Soviet Union.
Well, no doubt. There's absolutely no doubt. And we would have probably a Soviet Socialist Republic of Spain to this day. I mean, even though the rest of the Soviet Union, well, in pretense...
Nominally, it's
disintegrated.
Gone.
It disintegrated in pretense. In reality, it's still there.
The same Jews are still in power. It's just the KGB has become the FSB.
Absolutely.
The Russians are just too dumb to realize it.
The absolute proof that Soviet communism, that Bolshevism was the work of the Jews, is the fact that when the property of the people was liquidated by the government, it ended up in the hands of 10 Jews.
The oligarchs, and they're all Jews.
Well, absolutely. Every one of them.
All right, then.
No, I mean, if you don't need any other proof, just look at that. It's just incredible that Americans don't see it.
All right, then. So next week, French Revolution.
Praise Yahweh.
Yahweh bless. Thank you.